When I woke up, the memory of my unpleasant half-hour with Smyson returned. I did a slow shuffle to the bathroom. Ralph joined me while I gloomily studied my face in the mirror. My black eye had turned a deep purple, streaked with yellow and green. My jaw had turned gray. The whole effect was unappealing. Ralph seemed to share my feeling. My bet was that his ex-wife had never come home with a black eye. Suburban life is so dull.
"Do you do this kind of thing often?"
Ralph asked. "Not as much as I did as a child. The law of the jungle ruled in my high school. If you couldn't swing a mean fist, you might as well forget it."
"I don't think I was ever in a real fight,"
Ralph said slowly.
"Did all the girls in your school fight?"
"No, some of them just got scared off, and some got themselves boyfriends to protect them. The rest of us learned to protect ourselves."
Ralph said, "I'll make some coffee if you'll tell me the secret. I couldn't find any. And I didn't know whether you were saving those dishes for Christmas, so I washed them."
I'd forgotten the dishes in the sink. "Coffee's in the freezer," I said, "and the pot is still in the sink, unless you washed that too." After I'd soaked the stiffness out of my joints, I enveloped myself in a large blue towel and walked, with much less difficulty, to the living room. Ralph came in with the coffee.
"The weather's broken," he remarked. "I went out to get a paper, and it's clear and cool. Want to drive out to the Indiana Dunes?"
"No. It sounds lovely, but I'm not taking the day off."
"Well, how about some company? Need someone to drive you?"
I studied his face. Was he just having an attack of male protectiveness, or did he have some reason for wanting me to stay off the job? As a companion, he'd be able to keep tabs on my errands and report them to Earl Smyson. I said, "I'm going to Winnetka to talk to Peter Thayer's father. Since he's a neighbor of your boss, I'm not sure it would look too good for you to come along."
"Probably not. How about dinner tonight?"
"Ralph, for heaven's sake, you're beginning to act like a seeing-eye dog. I want some time to myself."
"Okay, okay. Just trying to be friendly."
"I know." I put an arm around him. "I'm just trying to be unfriendly." I hobbled back to the bedroom and put on my green linen slacks with a pale lemon shirt and jacket. Perfect for suburbia. Ralph walked downstairs with me and won points by not lingering over his goodbyes. I watched him out of sight, then hailed a passing cab. The driver dropped me in a neighborhood even more decayed than mine. I rang Lottie Herschel's bell.
"My dear Vic, what on earth is wrong with you?"
she greeted me. Lottie was a doctor, about 50, I thought, but with her vivid face and trim body, it was hard to tell. Sometime in her Viennese youth, she had discovered the secret of perpetual motion. She'd been one of the physicians who performed abortions when abortion was illegal and a dirty word to most doctors. Now she ran a clinic in a shabby storefront down the street. She'd tried running it for nothing, but found that the neighborhood people wouldn't trust medical care they didn't have to pay for. She sat me on a daybed.
"So now, Victoria, what have you been doing that turns your face black and blue? I am sure not a car accident. That's too tame for you, am I right?"
"Right as always, Lottie," I answered. I gave her an account of my adventures with Earl Smyson. Lottie pulled my face muscles and looked at my eyes with an ophthalmoscope.
"Nothing time won't cure," she pronounced.
"Yes," I agreed. "But my leg muscles are sore, too, and slow me down quite a bit. And I need something that will help me overlook the pain. Do you have anything?"
"Ah, yes, a miracle drug."
Lottie was amused.
"You shouldn't put so much faith in doctors and drugs. However, I'll give you a shot of phenylbutazone. That's what they give racehorses. They call it boot for short. In half an hour, you'll be ready for the derby, my dear."
As she talked, I felt a small sting, and it was over. Then she said,
"I'll also give you some Nepenthe to take away, and pack some boot and tablets for you."
She packed the boot tablets in a plastic bottle and gave me a bottle of Nepenthe. Then she saw me to the door.
"Seriously, Vic, if you get worried about Smyson, you are always welcome in my spare room."
I thanked her. It was a good offer, and one that I might need. I caught a cab to my office, picked up Peter Thayer's card with the Winnetka address on it, then flagged another cab back to my own car. Thayer's residence was on the side which faced Lake Michigan, giving the houses private beaches and boat moorings. I took a card from my wallet and wrote on it, "Let's talk about your relations with the knife grinders." Then I rang the bell. The disapproving expression of the uniformed maid who answered the door reminded me that I had a battered face. "I'd like to see Mr. Thayer," I said coolly. She took the card, shutting the door in my face. As the minutes passed, I left the porch to make a study of the flower bed on the other side of the drive. When the door opened again, I turned back. The maid frowned at me. "I'm not stealing the flowers," I assured her. "But since you don't have magazines in the waiting area, I had to look at something." She sucked in her breath.
"This way."
No please, no manners. Still, this was a house of mourning. I made allowances. We moved at a fast clip to the back of the house. John Thayer met us, coming from the other direction. His air was subdued, as if he were consciously trying to act like a mourning father.
"Thanks, Lucy. We'll go in here."
He took me into a room with comfortable armchairs and bookcases. He held out my card.
"What's this about, Warshawski?"
"Just what it says. I want to talk about your relations with the knife grinders."
"They were minimal. And now that Peter is gone, I expect them to be non-existent."
"I wonder if Mr. McGraw would agree with that." He clenched his fist, crushing the card.
"McGraw hired you to blackmail me, didn't he?"
"Then there is a connection between you and the Knife Grinders Union," I said.
"No."
"Then how can Mr. McGraw possibly blackmail you? Look, Mr. Thayer, something was going on between you two that your son found out, and you two had him killed to keep him quiet."
"That's a lie, Warshawski. The police arrested Peter's killer this morning."
I stared at him in disbelief.
"Yes, they found a drug addict who tried to rob the place. They say Peter caught him at it and was shot."
"No," I said. "No one robbed that place. I tell you, Thayer, the boy was sitting at the table and someone shot him. Besides, nothing was taken."
"What are you after, Warshawski? Maybe the killer got scared and flew. I'd believe that before I'd believe your story."
"Mr. Thayer, a couple of punks roughed me up last night to warn me off the investigation. A drug addict doesn't have those kind of resources. But I've been to see several people who might have engineered that, and you and Andy McGraw were two of them."
"People don't like busybodies, Warshawski. If someone beat you up, I'd take the hint."
He went over to his desk.
"I can see you're a conscientious girl, but McGraw is wasting your time."
He wrote a check and handed it to me.
"Here, you can give McGraw back whatever he's paid you and feel you've done your duty."
The check was for $5,000. "You bastard," I said. "You accuse me of blackmail and then try to buy me off?" I ripped up the check and let the pieces fall to the floor. The door opened and a girl came in.
"Oh, Dad, Mother wants you to... Sorry, didn't know you had company."
She was an attractive teenager, wearing jeans and a striped man's shirt. Maybe it had been her brother's.
"Miss Warshawski was just leaving, Jill. Why don't you show her out, and I'll go and see what your mother wants."
Jill led me back the way I'd come earlier. "I'm very sorry about your brother," I said. "I'm afraid I found his body the other morning.
Peter once told me you could decide whether to trust people by their faces," she said. "But yours is pretty banged up, so I can't tell. Did Dad ask you to come out here? Why was he so angry?"
"Well, he thinks the police have arrested the murderer, but I think they've got the wrong person." Her face screwed up as if she were afraid she might start crying. I put an arm around her.
"I'm okay," she muttered. It's so terrible. Pete dying and everything. And Dad's so crazy, raving on about how Anita and her father shot Pete for his money and how it served Pete right. Like he's glad he's dead or something." Dad was in such a stew about Pete disgracing the family name, you know. But even if he had become a union organizer, he would have been a successful one. And I like Anita. She and Pete took me out sometimes when Mom and Dad were out of town.
She's disappeared, I told her. She looked at me with troubled eyes.
Do you think something's happened to her?
No, I said, with a reassurance I didn't feel. I think she got scared and ran away.
Anita's really wonderful, Jill said. But Dad and Mother refused to meet her. Nobody really cares about Pete. Mother just cares about the neighbors. Dad keeps saying it was Mr. McGraw, but I get the crazy idea that Dad killed Peter.
She started sobbing convulsively, and I held her close. Then the door opened behind us, and Lucy stood there, scowling.
Your father doesn't want you standing around gossiping with the detective.
I dug a card out of my purse. Call me if you need me, Jill, I said to her. Day or night. I wanted to get back and call Bobby and get the lowdown on this drug addict they'd arrested, but I needed to do something else while Lottie's painkiller was still doing its work. I had to get a gun. It wouldn't completely protect me against the likes of Smyson, but it might narrow the odds. I stopped at the Bagel Bakery where there was a phone booth and let my fingers do the walking through the yellow pages. I located a Smith & Wesson 38 at Riley's on the far side of the city. It was close to 5 when I got there.
I need a driver's license and credit card, and I have to ask you to sign this register,
the manager said, looking suspiciously at my battered face. He walked to one of the cases, unlocked it, and took out a gun. I balanced it in my hand and tried the classic police firing stance. It felt good. Okay, I said. I'll take it. Give me a couple of boxes of ammo and a shoulder holster.
Monday you should go down to City Hall, he said, and register that gun, and they'll forward your name to the Chicago police.
My last bit of energy had gone buying the gun. I couldn't drive back to my apartment. I went down the street looking for a motel and found a Best Western. The room was quiet, the bed firm. I peeled off my clothes and crawled under the covers. I came to, refreshed. I had slept more than 12 hours. I pulled on slacks and shirt and went down to the lobby for a copy of the Sunday Herald Star. Drug addict arrested in banking heir's murder was on the front page. It went on. Police arrested Donald McKenzie early Saturday morning. The Browning automatic that fired the fatal bullet has not yet been traced.